This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
But tonight, I'm so very happy to welcome the intrepid Justin Peters for his new work, The Idealist, Aaron Schwartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. You all came out of hibernation and strapped on your snow boots to be here, and I suspect it is for the same reason that I did. A deep and even passionate interest and curiosity in the brilliant life of Aaron Schwartz. No one knows more about Aaron's life and the circumstances that ultimately controlled it than Justin Peters. A correspondent for Slate since 2005 and a contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review, Justin first probed Aaron's story in a biographical piece for Slate. Written just weeks after Schwartz's death, this article became the genesis of The Idealist. In The Idealist, Justin traces Aaron's life, devotion to free internet culture, and the court case that ultimately drove him to despair. And then he uses Schwartz's situation to examine the evolution of copyright law and looks at the historical narrative that led to a legal situation like his. It's quite a feat, really. Tonight, Justin will be in conversation with Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate and the host of Hang Up and Listen. Josh actually commissioned Justin's original piece on Schwartz and has been witness to every step of Justin's reporting and editorial process. Please help me welcome Josh Levine and Justin Peters.
Thank you so much for the great introduction, and I'm incredibly proud to be here with Justin today. Like she said, I worked with Justin on the original piece for Slate, and I'm just, you know, thrilled to see that he continued to work on it. The piece was incredible. It was humane. It was smart. It was everything that Justin is as a journalist. And the book has, you know, shown that in full flower as well. We're going to start by having Justin read an excerpt from the book.
Yeah, thanks, Josh, and thanks, Liz. I'm going to read a few pages from the introduction. And then if there's a clamor from the audience at some later moment, I might read something else. All right. The introduction is called The Bad Thing. On Friday, January 4th, 2013, Aaron Schwartz awoke in an excellent mood. He brought his girlfriend, Taryn Steinbrichner-Kaufman, up to the roof of their apartment building in Brooklyn, New York. Under overcast skies, he turned to her and said, unprompted, "This is going to be a great year." The statement was wildly optimistic. 2 years earlier, Schwartz had been caught using the computer network at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to download millions of scholarly journal articles from the online database JSTOR. While downloading academic articles is not in itself against the law, doing so in bulk without explicit authorization is. Or at least that's what the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston had claimed. Schwartz was arrested and indicted on felony computer crime charges that carried a maximum penalty of 95 years in prison and more than $3 million in fines. He ran no risk of receiving the top sentence, but his friends and family did not think he deserved any prison time at all. When his former girlfriend, Quinn Norton, met with the prosecutors in April 2011, she marveled at their stubborn insistence that excessive downloading was a serious crime. I told them this case was ridiculous. I told them not to do this, she wrote later of the meeting. They listened in silence. The prosecutors, as prosecutors tend to do, were using the threat of a long sentence to pressure Schwartz into pleading guilty. But they were adamant that any plea bargain would have to include at least some jail time. But Schwartz refused to sign any plea that would send him to prison. He resented that the supervised released program that would follow any prison term would restrict his access to computers. Nor was he keen to have a felony conviction on his record. Several months after his arrest, Schwartz and Norton had visited Washington, D.C. They walked by the White House. Schwartz got sad. "They don't let felons work there," he said. Aaron Schwartz was 26, small and dark, with shaggy black hair that fell below his ears, and an occasional beard that fell somewhere between stubble and scruff. As a boy, he had been ashamed of his body, which he felt was embarrassingly chubby. But time had straightened and sharpened his features, and now he was handsome and barely resembled the awkward young computer prodigy he had once been. Teenager in a million, The Sunday Times of London had dubbed him in 2001 when he was 14. In an article lauding him as a computer programmer whose gifts far exceeded the norm for his age. At 19, his whiz kid reputation only grew when Reddit, the internet startup he had helped build, was purchased by the publisher Condé Nast for an undisclosed sum said to be somewhere between $10 million and $20 million. Swartz never told anyone how much he earned from the sale, though it was clearly a substantial amount. His reticence became a running joke between us, Norton wrote, me prying, cajoling, pressuring, and Aaron never giving in. Swartz kept a lot of things to himself. When he first started dating Taryn Steinbrichter Kaufman, he withheld all details of his legal predicament, not even mentioning that he'd been arrested. Instead, he referred to his case, euphemistically, as the bad thing. The bad thing came into being during the first few days of January 2011, when network engineers at MIT discovered a laptop concealed in a basement closet and wired into the campus network. The computer had been programmed to download documents from JSTOR at a rapid rate. The school, under the guidance of the Secret Service, installed a surveillance camera, and on January 6, photographed a young white male with dark, wavy hair entering the closet to retrieve the laptop. The man attempted to conceal his face behind a bicycle helmet, but he was clearly Aaron Swartz. This discovery raised far more questions than it answered. Aaron Swartz was famous. He was neither a malicious hacker nor a vandalistic script kiddie, but rather a well-known programmer and political activist. He was friends with the internet icons, Lawrence Lessig and Tim Berners-Lee. He was a research affiliate at Harvard. His blog was internationally popular. So why was he skulking around an MIT basement, siphoning obscure research papers like some tenure-track cat burglar? What were his plans for the nearly 5 million JSTOR documents he had acquired? What in the world was he thinking? Even 2 years after his arrest, these questions remained unanswered. The prosecutors believed that Swartz intended to post the JSTOR archives for free on the internet. Since childhood, he had been affiliated with the Free Culture Movement, whose members believed the digital networks ought to remove barriers to information access, not erect them. That the internet ought not to be considered a bookstore so much as an infinite library, its contents made available for the benefit of all. Free culture is rooted in the public domain, a concept that dates back to the earliest formalized copyright laws. In America, when a work's copyright expires, that work falls into the public domain, which means that the public is free to use, modify, and distribute it at will without having to pay a fee or ask permission. In 1790, when the U.S. passed its first federal copyright statute, the standard copyright term lasted 14 years, with the 14-year renewal period. But by the time Aaron Swartz first started downloading JSTOR articles, the standard copyright term for new works in America lasted until 70 years after the author's death, and the public domain had correspondingly dwindled. The existence of the public domain implies that the public has an inalienable stake in works of culture and scholarship, even works that they did not themselves devise. The stories mean little unless they are told and retold, and in the retelling, new meaning accrues to the original tale. The effect a given work has on its audience, and vice versa, is intrinsic to its social value. Many free culture advocates believe the copyright terms should be reduced and the public domain should be reinvigorated. I want to see copyright regulation shrunken back down to where it came from, Swartz wrote in 2002 when he was 15. These freedoms likely won't be retroactive, and they certainly won't be easy, but we must try to achieve them. He even argued that restricting public access to useful knowledge was immoral, and that the information rich were obliged to share their bounty with the information poor. This sort of rhetoric horrifies many of the publishers, film studios, record companies, software developers, and other culture merchants whose businesses are based on the artificial maintenance of information scarcity. Radical free culture could drive them into bankruptcy, and they see unauthorized online file sharing not as an act of liberation, but one of larceny. To them, someone like Swartz wasn't an idealist, but a common thief. Stealing is stealing. Whether you use a computer command or a crowbar, and whether you take documents, data, or dollars, said U.S. Attorney Carmen M. Ortiz in a press release that announced Swartz's indictment. From her standpoint, American law and custom clearly established copyright as a property right, and society has derived clear benefits when the laws protecting property are vigorously enforced. Well, writing for the online magazine Guernica, days after the indictment, two of Swartz's friends ridiculed Ortiz's simplistic moral tautology. Stealing is phrase-making designed to confuse the legal and moral distinctions between the kind of cybercrime everyone should oppose, such as stealing credit card and social security numbers, and efforts like Aaron's to make knowledge more accessible to the educated public. Ms. Ortiz, incredibly, ask the public to ignore the motive behind the act. And the thing is that Swartz never publicly revealed his motives. He rarely discussed the case at all, even with his closest companions. His silence seemed impelled by shame, by an intrinsic emotional solitude, and a reluctance to involve his friends in his troubles, lest they, too, incur the government's wrath. As Steinbrechner Kaufman later said, Swartz generally believed that he shouldn't rely on anyone else. Strength meant standing alone. His self-reliance often proved debilitating, to the extent that even the prospect of asking a flight attendant for a glass of water was enough to send him into spasms of guilt. I feel my existence is an imposition on the planet. Not a huge one, perhaps, not a huge one at all, but an imposition nevertheless, he wrote in 2007. He was 21. Even among my closest friends, I still feel like something of an imposition. And even the slightest shock, the slightest hint that I'm correct, sends me scurrying back into my hole. He had been in his hole since his arrest, in a manner of speaking, and at times it seemed like he'd never be able to emerge. His decision to spurn the proffered plea bargain had irked the prosecutors. And since then, the two sides had been at loggerheads. As the April 1, 2013 trial date approached, the lead prosecutor said that he would request a federal guideline sentence of at least 7 years in prison if he won the case. But new years represent new beginnings. At the start of 2013, Swartz saw reason for optimism. He had new lawyers from Kecker and Van Ness, a San Francisco firm that specializes in intellectual property law and white-collar criminal defense. His lead attorney was prepared to argue that the authorities had inappropriately searched and seized Swartz's computer and hard drive, and hoped to convince the judge to bar prosecutors from using any of the evidence they had found therein. If these suppression motions succeeded, and maybe the prosecutors could be induced to offer a better deal. Maybe Swartz would go to trial and win. We're going to win. I'm going to get to work on all the things I care about again, Swartz told his girlfriend on their rooftop that day. And that list of his passions was long. He had innumerable interests, and he indulged them all, which was a trait that occasionally exasperated the colleagues and collaborators who struggled to command his full attention. He was a programmer and a political activist, an aspiring author who had started and abandoned drafts of several books. He had recently become a contributing editor to a small magazine called The Baffler. He was beginning to research the best ways to reform federal drug policy. He loved the novelist David Foster Wallace. He watched a surprising and astounding amount of television. Louie, Boss, for some reason The Newsroom, were all favorite shows. These guys get it. In 2006, Swartz penned a generalist manifesto in which he urged his readers to elevate their professional ambitions and transcend their self-imposed limitations. Software engineers, for instance, shouldn't settle merely for writing effective computer code. They should consider how to apply their talents towards more majestic ends. People are afraid of grandeur. It challenges the status quo, but you shouldn't be, he wrote. Look up more should be your motto. Think bigger, your mantra. He followed his own advice and came to think of himself as an applied sociologist, actively working to develop rational strategies for making the world a better place. Saving the world had long headed Aaron Swartz's bucket list, and he was intent on achieving that goal. In 2011, he even drafted a document titled How to Save the World, Part 1, in which he identified and analyzed 8 methods that could be used to amass power and influence policy, ranging from innovative public relations messaging to tactical legal pressure. Aaron Swartz planned to save the world by making it more effective. He was a voracious reader of business books, the biography of investor Warren Buffett, that of Walmart's founder Sam Walton, anything that might contain insights into organizational behavior and successful management strategies. At the beginning of 2011, in a capsule review of a book about the Toyota Motor Corporation, Swartz wrote that lean production, the Toyota management strategy that prioritized perfectly efficient manufacturing techniques, was undoubtedly the greatest human art form, he wrote, and he meant it, with sex running a close second, he clarified. He was obsessed with systems, optimizing and improving them, with making things work where they hadn't before. The revolution will be A-B tested, he liked to say, meaning essentially that the most effective organizations recognized their successes and their failures, learned from both, and adjusted their tactics accordingly. The revolution will be A-B tested with something of a life philosophy for Aaron Swartz. In project after project, he probed and tinkered until he had elicited the answers he was seeking, forever iterating his way toward the ideal outcome, the logical solution. The bad thing was bad in part because it resisted logical analysis. Aaron Swartz had no criminal record. His alleged crime was neither violent nor actively malicious. He returned everything he had downloaded in JSTOR, conscious of its public image, told prosecutors it did not want to see him go to prison. Yet the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston had delivered a 13-count felony indictment and pursued the case with what Swartz and his allies considered disproportionate zeal. Getting caught inside an irrational, inflexible system, one that made no provisions for his own exceptionalism, was one of Swartz's great fears. He had fled from most of the hierarchies he had encountered during his life, high school, college, the business world. He departed all 3 prematurely, after finding himself unable to accept their partitions and constraints. The Department of Justice was yet another sclerotic institution, best withdrawn from rather than withstood. But a defendant cannot unilaterally withdraw from a criminal indictment. And that was perhaps the worst, most frustrating thing about his legal situation. He couldn't improve it. And he couldn't escape it. I'm gonna go on. But not much longer. On the morning of Friday, January 11, 2013, Swartz seemed particularly morose, in sharp contrast to his earlier optimism. He was slow to rise from bed and told Steinbrechner Kaufman that he was going to stay home from his job at the global tech consultancy ThoughtWorks. I said, well, why don't I stay home with you and we'll go for a hike? We'll go for a hike today, she remembered. And he said, no, he just really wanted to rest and he needed to be alone. When she got to work, she contacted their mutual friend, Ben Wickler, and organized a dinner party for that evening in hopes that the gathering might lift Swartz's spirits. Wickler had introduced the two of them at the end of 2010, toward the end of Aaron's relationship with Quinn Norton. In the first 8 weeks that I started dating him, he quit 2 jobs, broke up with his ex-girlfriend, moved from Cambridge to New York, and was indicted, Steinbrechner Kaufman recalled. So it was kind of a big time in his life. Despite these adverse circumstances, a romance flourished between the two. Early in their courtship, Swartz joined Steinbrechner Kaufman and 2 mutual friends on a strawberry-picking excursion, much to his evident displeasure. Strawberry-picking wasn't his idea of a productive way to spend the afternoon, one of the holidaymakers recalled later in a significant understatement. He was very much Terrence's idea. And I remember joking to her later that he must have really liked her. In the spring of 2012, they began to cohabitate, sharing a small apartment near Prospect Park in the Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn, blocks from the old Ebbets Field. We would joke about how the two of us would really confuse the census, Steinbrechner Kaufman said. We could be reasonably recorded as 2 unmarried high school dropouts living together in a one-room studio. As their relationship progressed, though, Swartz gradually began to bridge the emotional distance that had long set him apart from the rest of the world. Early in our relationship, he didn't want to feel like he was dependent on me in any way, Steinbrechner Kaufman remembered, and I think that changed a lot. I think that he saw us as a pair that could compensate for each other's strengths and weaknesses. As 2012 drew to a close, their love was stronger than ever before. On the evening of January 11, 2013, Steinbrechner Kaufman stopped at Wickler's apartment on her way home from work. As she played with Ben Wickler's newborn son, she mentioned that Swartz had told her that he might consider getting married after his case was resolved. Swartz had long scorned the idea of marriage, but he was beginning to reconsider his opposition. If that was possible, if a reversal like that was possible, anything was possible. Less than 2 miles away, in a small and dark studio apartment, Aaron Swartz was already dead by his own hand.
That was great. Thank you. I now want to pass the hat for the Justin Peters audiobook of The Idealist, which I would buy many times. You get a great sense of the book from that introduction and of kind of the scope and the sweep of it. It's this evocative portrait of Aaron Swartz, but one of your crucial insights from the very beginning of when you started looking into his life was that the story of his life was one of someone who is obsessed with ideas and something bigger than himself. And so it's only natural that the book would be about ideas and something bigger than one person as well. So kind of how did you think about, or how did you decide how to make it bigger and how to expand it, what you would cover besides just the story of this fascinating guy's life?
And I will say that I think it was you that definitely sort of helped me get that initial insight, like when I was first writing this Slate piece. I think you like said something like, look, there's lots of kids out there who are obsessed with model trains, but like...
It doesn't sound like something I would say.
No. but then you said, but like, there's like fewer of them who are obsessed with like the tracks and like the proper like gauge and like stuff like that. And then you went on and on about trains. So like after I finished like the book, I'm like, you know what? Like this story that I wrote for Slate is 15,000 words long. It's the longest thing I've ever written, and my God, I'm just scratching the surface here, because the story of Aaron Swartz, like you're right, it's more than just the sort of chronological retelling of his life and the circumstances of his death. It really is the story of the sort of ideas that obsessed him and the laws in which he got sort of like entangled. And what I wanted to do was fitting that in sort of a book about Aaron Swartz, that it would be more about like his role in sort of a larger system, you know, and like by trying to sort of explain the genesis and perpetuation of that larger system, that maybe it would be a way to sort of like better explain what happened to him and like both in the way he lived his life and the way that he ended it. So when I first sort of like made that decision, I asked myself, well, like the key question here is, how did we get to the point where academic research papers are considered private property, indistinguishable from like the latest Brad Thorne novel, and downloading those papers like without explicit permission is considered a federal crime, punishable by up to decades, like in jail. And I didn't know the answer, so I'm like, well, you know, this probably goes back to the beginnings of copyright law. And once I started looking into that, it is the nerdiest thing to say that I was hooked. I'm like, this story needs to be told. and I resolved that it was my book and I wanted to tell it.
Nobody could tell you not to.
No, despite the fact that people told me not to.
People could tell you not to.
Yeah, that is the benefit of just not answering your emails for 6 months and, like, your editors can't contact you and tell you, like, don't write that book, write another. That didn't actually happen, but they were actually happy. Like, they're like this. Look, that's a story, right? Honestly, the story of Aaron Swartz is a story of systems. It really is. He knew that. He knew that the story of the world in which we live is the story of the systems that sort of control, like, the way that we live, how they exist, why they are the way they are, how they can be sort of, like, tweaked or improved, like the extent to which, like, just regular people have the ability to sort of peer inside sort of systems, like discern, like, the way in which, like, they work and offer, like, ways to sort of make them work better, is, like, it was the it's the fundamental sort of, like, one of the fundamental conflicts of, like, this era, like, is the world the sort of place that sort of welcomes sort of outside input, or is this sort of a top-down sort of hierarchical sort of organization where it's like, well, you know, climb the ladder, guy, like, and when you get to the top rung, like, then you can tell everyone how the world should work.
One of the things that really fascinates me about him is that there are a lot of people who want to change the world, to think about it kind of abstractly, dreamers and people who think things don't work and maybe wouldn't it be great. This is a guy who, some of the things that you're reading that he wrote, and people were kind of chuckling, like, this is like a 13-year-old saying, like, you know, with just like really strong opinions about how things should be and just very offended by the world as it is. And the turn here is, he wasn't somebody who just wrote on his blog. He actively tried to enact his ideals. He tried to change the world. And people like that are rare and strange. And there are parallels to him, you know, that you found throughout U.S. history.
Yeah. So, like, the book sort of starts off with a bunch of chapters on, as you said, sort of parallel figures that I found throughout sort of U.S. history who shared with Aaron Swartz the sort of ambition to change the world by making sort of like good information like more free or more sort of easily accessible, and resolved to harangue the American public in one way or another into caring about the political implications of information access. So I sort of go through sort of 250 years of American information history like that. Just like that. Yeah, thank you. It starts off with Noah Webster, right? Noah Webster, if you remember him at all, it's the guy, it's the dictionary guy, right? Like, yeah, the dictionary guy. Most people probably think that his first name is Merriam, right? But before he was confused with, like, someone else, you know, or before people confused him with Daniel Webster, he was, like, a 26-year-old, like, schoolmaker who aspired to schoolmaster who aspired to change the world by giving people better grammar. This was right in the sort of interregnum between the British rule and the Constitution, in the sort of like Articles of Confederation period, where like America was like, okay, we're a country now. Like, let's start figuring out what that means. At the time, sort of most sort of American children, if they went to school at all, they were taught to sort of read and speak using this book called The New Guide to the English Tongue, written by a dead British schoolmaster named Thomas Dilworth. Noah Webster hated this book beyond all sort of like rationality, like a reason. Like, he was like, what good is it for the children of this country to learn from this book when pages upon pages are devoted to the proper pronunciation of Welsh and Irish towns? It is madness. Webster was the sort of guy who at least 12 times a day deemed something like madness. And one of the things he deemed madness is that his own sort of like speller that he wrote in sort of answer to Dilworth's book, which was like a very sort of deliberately American, you know, work of sort of grammatical instruction, you know, teaching people to think in and sort of speak in American English rather than an American inflected like British one. One of the things he found crazy is that there was no copyright law to help sort of protect his work. Webster wanted to be rich and famous, and he also wanted this work to spread across, like, the country so that everyone should benefit from it. But it was impossible for it to spread without sort of a copyright law, because no publisher would take a chance on publishing it without this sort of guarantee that their investment wouldn't eventually go to naught because someone else would pirate it. So he sort of rode around the 13 states for about a year and a half, stopping at each sort of state house and individually sort of lobbying each sort of legislature to pass sort of an individual sort of copyright law. And one by one, the sort of like the states fell, right? Until when in 1790, the first federal copyright statute like was passed, like everyone ended up calling Noah Webster the father of American copyright, him most of all. He called himself that. But like he was the first person to like try to raise sort of a like to make Americans aware of the sort of political implications of the stuff that you read, right? And ever since then, that sort of question has I don't know. There's lots of people like him in.
Let's talk about Michael Hart.
Yes,
who,
please.
Was a guy who you say like. Put the first ebook on a computer, and this is someone who struck me as being extremely similar to Aaron Swartz in kind of his outlook and his ideals.
Yeah. So Michael Hart, we'll jump forward like 180 years now. In 1971, Michael Hart was an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where he somehow was given access to this gigantic mainframe computer called the Xerox Sigma 5. Hart was one of these guys who, like Webster and like Swartz, like very much wanted to change the world and very much sort of like went around like telling people, I'm going to change the world. Why isn't the world changing yet? He tried to become like a folk singer, like his songs like weren't any good. He had like rambled around the country and he's like, my window of opportunity is closing. The 60s are over, man. Like, what's like, how's the world going to change? And he's like, well, geez, there's this gigantic computer here. This is something new. And he said to himself, like, and to the other people who were around him, much like every other character in this, every character in this book spent a substantial portion of their waking hours proclaiming things to people who may or may not have wanted to listen. Hart said something like, the value to society provided by computers will not be in sort of computation, but will be in the retrieval and storage of what is stored in our libraries. So basically, he had this insight that like computers and digital networks like had the potential to be this sort of infinite library, right? And he soon realized that someone was going to have to stock that digital library shelves. So starting in 1971, Hart devoted the next 40 years of his life towards typing up sort of public domain classics, works of literature, patriotic documents. He spent the entire 1980s inputting the entire King James Bible. It's a very long book. And he called his endeavor Project Gutenberg because he felt that what he was doing had the capacity to transform the world and the way that people received and interacted with information as much as movable type had in 1450. And no one believed him. No one ever does. No one ever believes these people when they say stuff like this. And so actually no one listened to Michael Hart until around 1991 when the World Wide Web came around. And gradually he started connecting with other sort of oddballs and idealists around the world who said, hey, this is pretty cool what you're doing. Let me help. And gradually their archives kept on building. And this is where the other theme of the book comes in. Until in 1996, they had 250 sort of like books, public domain books on language. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot. When you think that this is not sort of like scanning like these books, these are people sitting at their desks manually inputting like all of these works. And Hart had hopes that by the year 2000, there'd be like 2,000 like books online. And then Congress comes around and they're like, what ho, the internet is here. This is disturbing. And it was more that the Walt Disney Corporation was like, oh, this is disturbing. And other corporations were like, this is disturbing. We need to extend copyright terms. the public domain is the equivalent of a weedy, sort of like dirty, vacant lot. Like, it means no one cares about it. The only people who care about sort of like works of like literature are the people that hold the copyright on them. So they petitioned Congress to pass a Copyright Term Extension Act. They call it the Sonny Bono Act because before he died in a tragic tree accident, Sonny Bono believed that copyright should be eternal. And his colleagues in Congress effectively decided to grant his wish when they extended copyright terms by sort of like 20 years in 1998. And so you've got these sort of dual themes, like the coevolution of like the digital realm and its capacity to transform the world, and the laws meant to sort of like govern that realm. And sort of the book sort of tells the sort of story of the sort of growth and genesis of those laws until I bring Aaron Swartz back into it in 2002, where and he's on the steps of the Supreme Court, waiting to hear the oral arguments of this case called Eldred v. Ashcroft. Eric Eldred was this other sort of volunteer librarian like Michael Hart who had this sort of big online sort of library called Eldritch Press. In sort of like 1999, after the CTAA passed, he joined forces with a law professor named Lawrence Lessig, and they filed suit to sort of challenge the legality of the Copyright Term Extension Act. This thing wended its way upwards until in 2002 it made it to the Supreme Court. And the night before, all of the sort of public domain enthusiasts in America gathered on the steps of the Supreme Court. There weren't many of them. It was a very small sort of like group to sort of camp out and wait for tickets so that they could be assured of sort of gaining admittance. And Aaron Swartz was there. He was 14 years old. Yeah, it is amazing. It's crazy. When I was 14 years old, I was trying to try out for JV basketball, you know? Like, Aaron Swartz, like, convinced his parents somehow to let him fly to Washington, D.C. by himself, hang out with a bunch of, like, people from San Francisco he had never met before, and sit there and watch oral arguments. And not only did he watch them, he wrote this long, elaborate sort of blog post about the sort of experience and sort of like everything. And there's this part that gets me, that always really gets me. After Eldred v. Ashcroft had concluded, he and his friend Seth wandered sort of next door from the Supreme Court to the Library of Congress, and they go up to the reading room, the Jefferson Building. And I'm sure you've been there. If you haven't, you should go. It's gorgeous. It's this sort of like temple, right, to the transformative potential of the written word, right? You know, right? That's basically what it is. And like they're standing there, they're like, oh my gosh, like we just like we're talking to the Supreme Court, gave them this challenge like to greatness, like yay, information is going to be free. And it wasn't, of course. They voted 7-2 against it. They're like, there's absolutely no merit in their sort of legal arguments. And all of the supporters of Eldred v. Ashcroft, like, turned their websites black in sort of protest. And that was his political awakening, I think. And ever since then, at age 14, it sort of set him on his path. He had found his tribe, right? You got to find your tribe. It's very hard if you're a 14-year-old kid in the suburbs of Chicago, which I was at one time, right, to find other people that, like, share your arcane interest. But he found them on the steps of the court. And, like, from then on, like, this sort of course of his life was basically set.
I want to ask you one last question, and then we can open it up to the group. But as you just said, he's very aware of his place in this lineage, in this history. And he was a friend and considered a colleague by Lawrence Lessig and Tim Berners-Lee, these sorts of towering figures in academia, or Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. And yet, the thing that's always kind of stood out to me is he takes all of the bulk downloads all of these documents from JSTOR, and he never says to anyone what he's going to do with them. He never articulates clearly why he's doing it. And you're, very clear in the book and in the article that you wrote about, there are some things that you can sort of find the answer to, and there are some things that you won't ever be able to. But was that question of like this last kind of act of his, and the one and the, you know, series of events that it set off, was it kind of important to you to think through what he was trying to do there, what he was hoping to accomplish, even though he never really explained it?
Yeah, it was, though I had to sort of resign myself to the fact that I was never actually going to be able to answer that question. I think that's okay. You know, there can be sort of like mysteries in the world, and sort of as a biographer and a journalist, you know, it would be irresponsible of me to sort of like, you know, go out there and sort of like speculate if I don't have any sort of specific evidence to like back anything up. That said, what I also sort of felt was really sort of important was to sort of demonstrate that this act, sort of downloading all this material from JSTOR, did not occur in a vacuum, right? Rather, it was sort of only sort of like when it happened the latest, and it turned out like the last in a series of sort of similar sort of bids to sort of acquire walled off sort of like data and to just have it, regardless of whether you do what you do with it, right? There's this sort of part in the book where I think the book gets good. pro tips, skip the first 150, please don't. So, right, he gets involved with Reddit, right? This sort of like company that sort of ends up getting purchased for like, you know, upwards of $10 million. And he's 19 when the sale goes through. If I was 19 and my company had just been purchased like by a gigantic media company, and I find myself in San Francisco at the cusp of like the social web, right? Right there. I'm the first guy there. I'm not moving for anybody, right? I am I'm setting a pick and I'm standing there and I'm sort of like everyone else can like try to go through me, but I'm not moving because I'm there and I've got my money, I'm gonna make more. And what he did that was so sort of curious and yet so in character, he's like, I'm here, I've got my money, this sucks. I hate it. I'm not doing anything worthwhile. This website is frivolous. I'm getting compensated so far out of proportion to the value that I'm adding to the world. And he blogged very openly about this. He blogged about like when he made it to San Francisco, they all moved out there after Condé Nast purchased Reddit. Like, he would spend his days crying in the office bathroom because he just couldn't, like, take being there. He stopped going to work, right? He flew to Europe to attend a hacker conference, and his, you know, coworkers only sort of learned that he was there when his picture as a conference attendee appeared on the front page of the Wired website. Eventually, sort of like, he left by sort of mutual consent. But right before he left, he posted this story on his website featuring sort of a protagonist named Aaron who committed suicide. And later he said, oh, it's just a story, man. I don't know why anyone would think it's realistic. Well, everyone would think it's unrealistic because he'd spent 3 months being like super depressed, right? Like feeling like there's nowhere sort of like to go from here. And his coworkers found it so realistic, they sent the cops to his apartment, break down the door to make sure he was okay. He was okay. And then he left Reddit, and for years thereafter, he was like, you know what? I've sort of veered off track. I'm going to do what I want to do for the rest of my life. So he started downloading all these sort of like big data sets, right? He downloaded the entire Westlaw database of law review articles and analyzed them to try to figure out what the effect of corporate funding was on sort of research outcomes. Spoiler alert, corporate funding affected research outcomes. He got involved with this project called Open Library, which was sort of a open source attempt to sort of compete with Google Books. And he ended up downloading sort of 450,000 public domain sort of works from the sort of Google Books sort of like archive to populate Open Library with. He got involved with an effort to acquire the entirety of a database called Pacer, which is this big sort of database of federal court records. And he took advantage of this federal trial program that you know, allowed people to download this records for free for a period of time. Normally it cost 10 cents a page. And he ran this sort of computer program that enabled rapid downloads. And he grabbed about 20 million pages before they cut off his access, and they sent the FBI to investigate him and figure out what he was doing and why he was doing it. So it doesn't surprise me that he went into MIT. In fact, if you were going to sort of like look at every single resident of Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2010 and vote on who was most likely to set up in the basement of MIT and download JSTOR, Aaron would have won. Like, hands down. Hands down. It would have been him. Richard Stallman would have gotten some votes. And then, like, that would have been it. And speaking of Stallman, I'll bring this to a close in a second. He went to this conference of sort of librarians in Italy in 2008, where he penned this thing called the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, which would come to be very sort of like an important document in the case against him. In this manifesto, he basically expounded on the moral necessity of taking giant data sets that were sort of restricted to the general public, acquiring them and putting them online for free for anybody to access. A couple years later, he spoke at this thing called Free Software Day at the offices of the Free Software sort of Foundation, where he continued to sort of like try to get people to participate in his guerrilla open access movement, and directed people to this website he had set up called guerrillaopenaccess.com, where they could all sort of come to participate in his project. GuerrillaOpenAccess.com linked to another site called the Content Liberation Front, which is just one page, right? On it, it was sort of an agenda, right? The stuff that the Content Liberation Front wanted to do. Like, the first thing on that list was acquire sort of like academic databases such as JSTOR and sort of like put the material online. On the bottom of that page, they said, listen, if you want to help, here's my address. Content Liberation Front, CEO Aaron Swartz. And he gave his apartment address, which was right down the road from MIT. We don't know what he was going to do with those articles that he took. What we do know is the sobriety with which he sort of approached these issues, the sort of moral clarity that sort of drove him to continue to sort of like work on these issues, and the intransigence of the forces that he was fighting against. It's about 3 years, a little bit more than 3 years since he died. This book came out 3 years and a day after his death. And it's hard to say that stuff has changed or gotten any better, you know? If anything, the sort of gigantic corporate forces that increasingly control the web have more power. There's more money sort of like going into their like coffers. In the intervening 3 years, sort of we've learned more and more about the extent to which the government uses sort of digital technology to monitor its citizens. Yeah, corporations as well. You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the act under which he was charged, hasn't been reformed. Sheldon Whitehouse, senator from Rhode Island, has, you know, for a while been trying to, you know, advance sort of a revision of that act that would make it even more sort of like broad and sort of expansive. And I think it'd be hard to sort of like argue that the world's gotten better. And people ask me a lot about what Aaron's legacy is. I don't know. It's for history to decide. I guess I am his biographer, so.
How dare they ask me?
Right? Yes. When people ask me, I'm like, get out! Get out! Buy a book and get out! I think his legacy is up to us to determine. It's up to us to sort of realize that the way the world might not have gotten better, it's up to us to try to see that it doesn't get worse. Thank you.
That's great. All right, let's take questions now. And if you can go to the microphones, we've got two of them.
Well, you've definitely piqued my interest, and I'm going to buy a book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This may be addressed in the book, but I wanted to ask you, you talked about systems, and I want to ask you about sort of individuals and organizations, because it seems as though as part of the sort of rise of, you know, this internet sort of hacker culture, there's this notion, and it seems embodied in sort of Aaron, that, you know, an individual empowered with the internet, with all these tools at our disposal, can sort of change the world. And you have this picture of Aaron sort of, you know, trying to do it on his own and also sort of suffering on his own when it doesn't sort of work out that way. And then you've got these corporations, which are organizations that oppose it. And I wonder, just is part of the story of Aaron's sort of life and his loss sort of a story also of this movement that has emerged in the past couple decades that may be a tad bit sort of naive, and that the internet may empower us in ways that we have not been empowered before, but that doesn't mean that we don't need to, there aren't advantages to organizations.
Yeah, and I what's actually interesting is, like, near the end of his life, of the last year of his life, he was obsessed with trying to build sort of a better organization. He had spent so much time fleeing from ones that didn't suit him, right? High school, college, the business world. He departed all three sort of prematurely, right? He bounced from job to job, you know? He found it sort of, like, difficult to sort of stick at any, like, one place. He was getting a reputation as someone who was sort of flaky, right? You know? And, like, just as the sort of advice of an escape artist can sometimes be useful in building better jails, you know, near the end of his life, he started realizing, well, like, I have this insight into the defects of organizations. Maybe I can use that to try to sort of build sort of a better one. And that's why he was so involved in reading these sort of, like, management books near sort of the end of his life. He was really sort of, like, working himself up to trying to sort of devise a group that, you know, could draw strength from sort of its numbers. And I think this goes back to his involvement in the protests against SOPA and PIPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act back in, you know, 2011 and 12. He was really integral in helping to galvanize the opposition to that and sort of create a bunch of the sort of online tools that helped bring those issues to just a general sort of internet user who had no real sort of idea of, and never really thought about the political implications of, you know, her casual sort of, like, web browsing. And the success that they had there sort of made him sort of, like, realize, you know, gosh, like, we can sort of, it's possible to put together a team, you know, that doesn't disempower, like, its individual players. Yeah, I think actually if he would have lived longer, like, he would have, like, definitely tried to build one. And I think it's one of the great shames that now we don't get to see what that team would have looked like.
First of all, thank you for a wonderful presentation. This was so worth braving the snow to come out here for this. I didn't know anything about Aaron's story before I came here tonight. It's been very interesting. As I was listening, I was wondering where genius and clairvoyance like that comes from. And did you learn anything about his parents or his grandparents, or what shaped him into who he was?
It's a really good question. So he grew up in a very wealthy suburb of Chicago called Highland Park, Illinois. His grandfather he had some sort of, like, business. He had made a bunch of money, but he also was instrumental in this organization called Pugwash that sort of promotes sort of world peace. They won some sort of, I don't think it was a Nobel Peace Prize. They won some sort of, like, peace prize when sort of, like, Aaron was very young. So speaking with his father, like, is very proud of Aaron's grandfather. And he's like, listen, this sort of sense of trying to sort of make the world sort of a better place was very much sort of ingrained, like, in our family tradition. His own father is an interesting guy. He was an inventor and a sort of computer consultant who actually has worked for many years as a consultant at MIT. And, you know, he told me that, you know, starting early in his life, Aaron had access to these sort of computing resources that just an average kid wouldn't. They had an ISDN internet access line starting back in like the early 90s. They had all of these sort of like tools their children were encouraged to experiment with and sort of play with them. Aaron said once, I don't think I'm a genius. I don't think I'm particularly sort of like talented. I just got a really big head start. That might explain his sort of technical acumen. His sort of moral clarity it's a little bit harder to sort of like get into, right? Like we all sort of like can point to people in our sort of like personal histories who were sort of like moral beacons, and yet we don't all sort of like live our lives sort of like in their sort of like in their examples. I don't have a great answer for you. I think it definitely had. I think it had something to do with the sort of communities he immersed himself in. Sort of like in his sort of early sort of like teenage years, he was very much sort of involved in these online sort of discussion groups that were devoted towards like making sort of the internet like a easier like an easier place, a more sort of like smooth sort of like place. And like these groups were very sort of like collaborative, very sort of idealistic. And the fact that they accepted him as sort of like a 13-year-old like suburban kid as sort of like an equal, like to them, he was judged by the contributions he made to the group. Like, I can only sort of imagine that like, as sort of a nerdy kid in Highland Park, you like see that and you see the way the rest of the world sort of like treats you. And you're like, well, you know, screw the rest of the world. Like I'm following like these guys' example. And then he got involved with sort of like Lawrence Lessig. I have to imagine that he was sort of a big influence in his life. And you can sort of extrapolate from there.
My question is rather a side issue of what you were talking about. Why do you think the government went after him with such vigor? I raise that particularly today if you read the Washington Post article on General Petraeus, who they, you know.
Oh, they didn't, yeah.
Right. So why did they go after him with such vigor? Did it have to do with the corporations? Did it have, you know, that's my question.
No, that's a really good question, and that's really central to the book. Couple answers. I don't know if they're good ones. First of all, you know, General Petraeus notwithstanding, that's what prosecutors do. Right? Like to some people, to people who aren't sort of like directors of the CIA, you know, like that's what prosecutors do. Like the reason I was on, Josh put me on this story, like in the first place back in 2013, was at the time I was on the crime beat for Slate. And the story seemed to sort of, I mean, grew from there, but like right in the days after his death, it was like, this is sort of like a crime story. Like genius under indictment, genius kills self. Go. And like one of the things that sort of like being a crime writer sort of like made me recognize is like the only abnormal thing about the way that the case against Aaron Swartz sort of played out was the fact that like we recognize right now that we're still talking about it. It's an abnormal thing. There are hundreds and thousands of sort of criminal defendants out there who get the same sort of like treatment, right? And like often it's like just standard procedure. It costs a lot of time and money for the government to bring someone to trial. So they try to sort of encourage them to take plea bargains. They do that by giving them these maximum sort of sentences, saying you might get this. Why don't you sort of like cut a deal, sort of with us?
Would it be fair to say that they're trying to make an example of him?
I think it's yes and no. To an extent, I think it's dangerous to overestimate the extent to which various sort of government departments actually communicate. If anyone's ever worked in a bureaucracy, like you know that like outsiders tend to think that like there's much clearer sort of communication than actually exists. So I don't actually think there was a mandate coming down from Eric Holder, you know, saying like, go after this guy, we'll show those hackers. I do think that it's plausible to assume that when he was arrested is right around the same time that sort of like WikiLeaks like was sort of in the headlines, right? And sort of Anonymous, the sort of hacking collective, you know, was frightening sort of everybody. And I think it's plausible that, you know, They see sort of Julian Assange sort of in Europe, can't get him. Anonymous is living up to their name, can't find them. But we've got this guy, this big hacker. That was the sort of phrase that recurred in the internal email traffic from the sort of like police who were sort of like catching him. I Googled him. He's a big hacker. Well, he was a lot of other things too. But like to someone like who is inclined to sort of like see hackers everywhere, like what he did looked like hacking. And it looked like it wasn't all that different from the stuff that sort of Assange and his colleagues were doing. And I feel like he sort of like it was bad timing on his part to get arrested like that. I think it very much has something to do with time and place.
Speaking of time, unfortunately, we are out of time. This was totally fascinating. Thanks so much to both of you. Thank you, Justin, and thank you, John.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.